The king sits in his palace on a big seat made of ebony like a throne. Over the royal dais on all sides are elephant tusks one beside the other. He hath with him his weapons, which are all of gold, sword, javelin, quiver, bow and arrows.
Mansa Musa, that's Emperor Musa in the Mandinka language, ruler of the West African nation of Mali in the first half of the 14th century, a territory covering more than 1 million square kilometres, and by some reckonings, the richest man who ever lived. I'm Fergus Nicol, and in this BBC World Service programme, I'll be looking at the life of a man whose profligate spending abroad is still the stuff of legend. The website celebritynetworth.com calculated that Mansa Musa had so much gold that his wealth outstripped even Bill Gates, amounting to around $400 billion in today's terms. That wealth helped shape his legacy at home, enabling a significant building program as well as educational and religious reforms. Descriptions of the opulent lifestyle at court even reached Arab historians like Ibn Fadlallah al-Umari.
30 slaves stand behind him, Turks and others who are brought for him in Egypt. One of them carries in his hand a parasol of silk surmounted by a dome and a bird of gold in the shape of a falcon. His princes sit around and below him in two ranks to right and left. Further away are seated the chief horsemen of his army. In front of him stand his sword-bearer and the official who acts as intermediary between the king and the people.
At its peak, the Kingdom of Mali stretched from the Atlantic Ocean in the west over to the northern heart of the continent, east of the long, slow bend of the Niger River. And from the sands of the Sahara in the north, crisscrossed by centuries-old camel trade routes, its southern fringes touched on the forests of coastal West Africa. And it was rich. Those trade routes used the ships of the desert to move huge quantities of copper, salt, kola nuts and ivory, north to the markets of the Mediterranean, east to Egypt and on into Arabia.
The country is very hot, and the means of subsistence are few. The people are tall, with jet-black complexion and crinkly hair. Their king controls the lands that he brought together by conquest and added to the domains of Islam. There he has built mosques and minarets and established the Friday observances and the Muazzin's call. He brought legal scholars to his country from Egypt, and there, becoming himself a student of religious sciences, continued as Sultan of the Muslims.
But what made the kingdom, and what made Mansa Musa a figure to be reckoned with, was gold. Here's how the king himself described what he called the gold crop. Here, Ibn Fadlallah al-Umari quotes an Egyptian noble who became friendly with Emperor Musa.
Ibn Amir Hajib said he asked him about the gold plant, and he said, it's found in two forms. One is found in the spring and blossoms after the rains in open country. It has leaves like wild grass, and its roots are gold. The other kind is found all year round on the bank of the Nile and is dug up. Sultan Musa told Ibn Amir Hajib that gold was his prerogative, and he collected the crop as a tribute.
In Timbuktu, Mali's northernmost town, the passing of seven centuries have hardly dented Musa's prestige. Here he's known by yet another title, Kanku Musa.
Kanku Musa est extrêmement pieux, extrêmement généreux.
Kanku Musa is extremely pious, extremely generous, and he's a man who'll never be forgotten in this town. In fact, not just in this city, but across the whole Muslim and Arab world.
Salem Ould Al-Hajj is a retired headmaster, Timbuktu's leading local historian, and the author of two books with snappy titles, Timbuktu, Volume 1 and Volume 2.
Les habitants étaient presque du sud.
The inhabitants were originally from the south. They were involved in the trans-Saharan trade with the nomads and with the Arabs from the Mediterranean. He made deals trading the produce of the north for merchandise from the south. What's important to recognize is that it was Kanku Musa who took Timbuktu and gave the town its first proper administration, including appointing a governor.
So was Timbuktu Mansa Musa's capital? It's certainly a city that's acquired an almost mythical reputation. Dr. David Conrad is the author of Empires of Medieval West Africa.
Timbuktu was one of the most important locations at the time. We know that he had a mosque built in Timbuktu and probably a residence, but that would have just been one of the important places for Mansa Musa in his day and his predecessors and successors. I've argued that there's no evidence, archaeological or otherwise, to support the idea that there was a capital as we think of capitals. The Mansa traveled a lot. When you think about the difficulties of communication in the 13th century, 14th century, and the difficulties of travel in those days, how do you govern it? How do you control it? How do you keep in touch? So the administrative center was where the Mansa was. Wherever he was, that's where the administration came from.
So what sort of ruler was Emperor Musa? Well, almost certainly more popular a figure than one of his successors, who was liable when practicing archery to use his subjects as targets.
What we can say for sure is there's no testimony in the Arabic sources and in oral tradition that he did bad things. And the fact that there's nothing said on the negative side of him suggests that he was very benign and well thought of. Also, he's credited with having sort of an enlightened approach to communication with the world above the Sahara. He had representatives in North Africa, and he was very forward-looking in that regard. He was very interested in the Mediterranean world and the Middle East and what Mali's role could be. The other big thing is, if he wasn't a good ruler, he wouldn't have been able to even consider going away for 2 years for that pilgrimage, because when he came back, he might no longer be in power.
Mansa Musa's two visits to Cairo in 1324, on his way to and back from Mecca, have echoed in history more loudly than any law passed, any mosque built, any praise song performed. The visit was quite simply sensational, not least for the staggering amounts of money that the Malian king dispensed on gifts, shopping, and generally smoothing the path of progress. He dispensed so much gold that he single-handedly devalued the currency for years to follow. Salem Ould al-Hajj in Timbuktu tells the story with pride, as if it were yesterday.
Kanku Musa was a very grand emperor. And back when Mali was rich, he distributed 13 tons of gold. Nowadays, of course, it's the other way round. Those same Arab countries are rich and we are poor, but they don't bother to share their petrodollars with us.
The king's retinue was enormous, 60,000 foot soldiers, hundreds of camels, and it took months to make the desert trek to Cairo and back again. Nor was the Hajj free from danger.
Danger naturel.
There were human dangers because brigands could ambush the pilgrim caravans. And there were natural dangers like the harsh climate and disease. It's not like today when you get on a plane and take 10 hours to get to Mecca. Back then, it was a huge undertaking.
The Egyptian dignitary who led the welcome party on behalf of al-Malik al-Nasr, the Egyptian ruler, described what happened when king met king.
When I went out to meet him, he did me extreme honor and treated me with the greatest courtesy. There he sent many loads of unworked native gold and other valuables to the royal treasury. I tried to persuade him to go up to the citadel to meet the Sultan, but he persistently refused. I realized that the audience was repugnant to him because he would be obliged to kiss the ground and the Sultan's hand. But the Sultan's protocol demanded that I should bring him into the royal presence, so I kept on at him till he agreed. When we came in the Sultan's presence, we said to him, "Kiss the ground," but again he refused outright. Then an intelligent man who was with him whispered to him something we couldn't hear, and he said, "I make obeisance to God who created me." Then he prostrated himself and went forward to the Sultan. The Sultan half rose to meet him and sat him by his side. They conversed together for a long time. Then Sultan Musa went out.
Mansa Musa's visits to Cairo in 1324 have been reported in various forms by generations of Egyptian historians. In fact, they're still taught on the curriculum at Cairo University. The man who teaches the course is the professor of Islamic history, Dr. Hussein Murad.
The importance of this trip by Mansa Musa is due to its grandiose and treasures, especially gold and raw gold. The Mansa Musa journey gained fame because it was recorded by great and big scholars and historians.
Are their accounts completely credible when we hear of the money spent by Mansa Musa in Cairo, the luxury of his retinue and so on?
The writings of Ibn Fadlallah al-Umari has credibility because of its time proximity, as Ibn Fadlallah al-Umari quoted eyewitnesses.
That kind of profligate spending might look just like showing off, but David Conrad insists that there's a Mandinka cultural subtext that shouldn't be ignored.
When he went to Cairo, his attitude would have been, he wanted to let the people of Cairo know that he could buy and sell them. And when he passed out all that gold, that implied that he was their benefactor and that they were part of his realm, as it were.
So he extended his patronage way beyond his own borders.
Exactly.
We've heard quite a bit of music in the programme so far, but most of it is related to Mansa Musa's grandfather, Sunjata Keita, founding father of the Mali Empire. These praise songs, performed by hereditary musicians called griot or djellis, represent Mali's oral history. And they're still played the way they were when they were composed, sometimes even on authentic medieval instruments. There are many versions of this Sunjata song, the tale of his life, peppered with wise and improving moral lessons. But I was surprised to find out that there seemed to be no equivalent song in praise of Mansa Musa. David Conrad suggested a couple of reasons why such a song may not have survived.
The fact that he was such a devout Muslim, you'd have to consider the possibility that he personally discouraged those because he became so involved and identified himself so deeply as a Muslim.
But Lucy Duran, who spent years studying Malian music and recording its greatest singers and instrumentalists, has another more down-to-earth explanation relating to that extraordinary expenditure of gold in Cairo. Can you tell me why I have been completely unable to find any such song about Mansa Musa? Am I not looking hard enough?
Well, this is a very funny story because in 1997, I went to the head of the griots of all Mali, a very educated man called Djeli Bakary Soumanon. And I asked Djeli Bakary whether he could tell me about the song for Mansa Musa. And he said, "Well, there is a song for Mansa Musa, but frankly, nobody wants to sing it." And I said, well, why not? You know, he was such a, obviously, a great emperor and, you know, made the pilgrimage to Mecca. And he said, well, the jellies don't like him because he took our gold and he distributed it around the world, and to such an extent that he devalued gold around the world. And he took our gold and left it in Cairo and Mecca and other places. So we lost our gold, and the jellies especially were incensed about it because that gold should have been for them. So there's no song. Though they rarely sing a song, they don't like to remember Mansa Musa.
It seems rather a serious oversight to alienate the people who would, after all, perpetuate your name, in more than buildings at least.
Well, do you think that's what he was thinking of? I think he was thinking he was doing the right thing by doing the Hajj. And he probably had absolutely no idea what was in store for him, and he probably thought there was a lot more gold where it came from. And so, you know, he loaded up his 100 camels with coffers of gold and was obviously a very generous man. Unfortunately, he wasn't generous enough with the jellies.
Mansa Musa's pilgrimage of 1324 triggered the modernization of Mali in a very Islamic context. The king didn't just bring back trade goods, he brought books, legal and religious scholars, civil administrators, and architects. These were the people who created some of Africa's preeminent early universities in places like Timbuktu, Gao, and Walata. Amu Mahman Didju is a professional calligrapher. He makes his living copying ancient texts, and he's a specialist in digging out obscure but important documents from Timbuktu's treasure trove of medieval manuscripts. The document he's reading from here is a regional history called Tariq al-Sudan, the history of the Sudan, by Sheikh Abdurrahman bin Abdullah bin Amran bin Amr al-Sadi. Even Amu doesn't know when it was written, but it brings together earlier historical sources as ancient as the 14th century, and it specifically describes the reign of Mansa Musa.
Sultan Kanka Musa huwa awwal man mallaka sughay min salatin malli.
These Malian historians had their Arab counterparts, and the most famous of them all, Ibn Khaldun, quotes the account of one man who claimed not only to have travelled to Mali, but to have enjoyed personal conversations with Mansa Musa himself and with a man who single-handedly reshaped Mali's cities, a poet turned architect from Andalusia called Abu Ishaq al-Sahili.
Nous sommes dans une allée de la grande mosquée Djingareber.
We are in an alley by the great Djingareber Mosque. And because it's Friday, you can see the long lines of people queuing up for prayers.
This is the legacy of Mansa Musa, as lived today in Timbuktu. Local historian Salem Ould al-Hajj guides his visitors through the 14th century Djingareber Mosque, its towering mud-built walls studded with protruding beams of timber.
On va rentrer.
Let's go back inside.
Si on regarde l'architecture de la mosquée,
if you look at the mosque's architecture, it was built in 1325 by the Emperor Kanku Musa when he came back from his pilgrimage with the Andalusian architect Abu Ishaq al-Sahili that he met in Egypt. This man combined Egyptian and European styles. So, if we look at the minaret, we can see that the base is very wide relative to its height, just like the pharaonic pyramids in Egypt. But on top of the central minaret, there's an ostrich egg, just as in Arab countries, they have a crescent moon.
Donc, vous avez vu.
So, as you've seen, this man put his personal stamp on the era because of his wealth. Thanks to him, from the time of his pilgrimage, the Muslim world and the Arab world came to Timbuktu. And the great geographers of the period put Mali and Timbuktu on their maps. And we became famous in the eyes of the whole world.
That's today's view in Mali itself. But in the medieval era, how much did people outside Africa know about what must have seemed a remote desert kingdom? Well, the answers may be unexpected, and I've come here to Paris to find it. This is the Bibliothèque Nationale de France, and I'm here to meet Emmanuel Vagnon, a specialist in maps of the period, to find out why Mansa Musa, holding a huge nugget of gold in his hand, features on a map of the world made in Spain.
We're speaking about a very special manuscript. It was a gift given by the King of Aragon to the King Charles V of France, and it was made in 1375. It's a book binded with leather. And it's a very special manuscript because it's composed with very fine gold and wonderful images showing the entire world.
How much of the world was recognized from this Eurocentric perspective at the time?
At that time, only three parts of the world were known: Europe, Africa, and Asia. And the Catalan Atlas is beginning in the Asian part of the world and is going westward until the Atlantic Ocean. So the last pages are centered on Europe and the Mediterranean world. So you don't have the whole image of the world in the same page.
What does the Catalan Atlas tell us about Africa?
The Catalan Atlas was made by cartographers in Mallorca. And this community of Mallorcan merchants were very aware of the commercial issues and commercial roads of Africa at that time. If we look at the last pages showing Western Mediterranean and Atlantic Ocean, we see both Europe and North Africa. And those maps are focused on the commercial roads between Europe and North Africa. So what we can see is principal cities and towns that were important for the commercial roads at that time. And then you have the representation of the main sovereigns of Western Africa. We can see King Moussa Mali, who is presented as the king of the Mali, a vast region of black people ruled by this very rich sovereign.
Let me just describe King Moussa in this picture. He's got a very splendid, very Western-style gold crown. He's got a kind of scepter, I guess, a royal sort of staff of some kind. And perhaps most importantly of all, he's got a huge, round nugget of gold. Where he's sitting on the throne is right by a very large river. We would call that the Niger today. What do they call it on the map?
They call it the Rio de l'Or, the River of Gold. It comes from a legend saying that the gold that you can find in Africa was coming from the rivers.
And I'm going to ask you to translate this, if you would, Emmanuel. We've got, is it Latin or is it Spanish?
It is Catalan language.
And this is on the map, right next to the head of Mansa Musa.
Here is the lord of the blacks. He's called Moussa Mali. He's the lord of all the blacks of Guinea. He's the richest and the noblest lord of all this region because of the abundance of gold that we can find in his land.
What he accomplished in his reign was bringing the attention of the outside world to the so-called land of gold below the Sahara. Now, that was a two-edged sword. It would cut both ways, because that, of course, captured the attention of the entire Mediterranean world and on into Europe. These ideas that there was this place below the Sahara that where the streets were paved with gold, and that's where the legends about Timbuktu arose.
And David Conrad's point is worth highlighting, because many believe that it was precisely that two-edged sword that prompted European exploration, European exploitation, and ultimately slavery and colonialism.
La population de sa capitale de son empire dit qu'il a appauvri son empire au profit des Arabes. Donc on a caché.
Today, Mali is one of Africa's poorest countries, and war has come to Timbuktu. Even the great Djengareba Mosque, a UNESCO World Heritage Site, has not been safe, nor the town's precious manuscripts. In July 2012, paramilitary forces calling themselves the Ansar Din, Defenders of the Faith, destroyed two tombs at the Djengareba Mosque
And at the nearby Sidi Yahya Mosque, they broke down a sacred door that had been closed for centuries. Salem Ould-Hajj recalled the legend that was desecrated.
Here it is, the door that would not open. The legend tells of a magician who was urged by his peers to convert to Islam. He came here to the mosque, but deep in his heart, he was not really converted. When the imam said, Allahu Akbar, he repeated those words and turned instantly into a hyena and went out through this door. And that's why the door was shut for so long, so that nobody would follow in his footsteps. Anyway, this is our new door. The old door, the sacred one, they took it away.
That smashed door could be taken as a metaphor for Mali's fortunes in the modern era. In historical terms, Mansa Musa's reign was the high watermark of the Mali Empire. Subsequent generations presided over a gradual shrinking and splintering of his mighty realm. Even the Niger itself abandoned Timbuktu, shifting over the centuries to its current course many kilometers away. To look back over 700 years at the imperial era is to revisit a world that looks impossibly distant, but also the source of a national pride that today is sometimes all too hard to find.